Good morning. It's my pleasure as the chair of the Shenandoah Anabaptist Science Society, SAS, to introduce today's chapel speaker. So I ran into Richard Beck's blog, Experimental Theology, through Facebook. One of my friends had posted an article that he had written about Facebook and the church, and that was how I stumbled upon his writings. Richard really exemplifies what SAS is about, which is looking at contemporary issues that intersect both the sciences and our faith. Richard is the chair and a professor of psychology at Abilene Christian University, and he researches the way in which psychological theories such as discuss psychology influence the way in which we act and influence our faith. And he's written several books that I would recommend, but you can also access his writings for free at Experimental Theology. So I would encourage you to check out his writings, and now we will get to listen to Richard himself.
Thank you. Good morning. How are you all this morning?
Wonderful.
If you're like my students, you're very sleepy in AM chapel. This evening, I'm going to be talking a little bit about the book that you see projected behind me, I think at 4 o'clock, the Science Center at 4 o'clock. But I want to share a little bit about it with you this morning. And to do that, to talk about, introduce this idea of radical hospitality, I want to read a parable by the writer Peter Rowlands. I don't know if any of you know Peter Rowlands. This is a little book of parables he wrote. Kind of counterintuitive parables, and this is a parable about radical or impossible hospitality. So let me read this to you and then make some comments about it. In the center of a once great city, there stood a magnificent cathedral that was cared for by a kindly old priest that spent his days praying in the vestry and caring for the poor. Now, as a result of the priest's tireless work, the cathedral was known throughout the land as a true sanctuary. And the priest welcomed all who came to his door, and he gave completely without prejudice or restraint. Each stranger was to the priest a neighbor in need, and thus the incoming of Christ. And his hospitality was famous, and his heart was known to be pure. No one could steal from this old man, for he considered no possession his own, and while thieves sometimes left that place with items pillaged from the sanctuary, the priest never grew concerned. He had given everything to God and knew that these people needed such items more than the church did. So one evening, in the middle of winter, while the priest was praying before the cross, there was a loud and ominous knock on the cathedral door. And the priest quickly got to his feet and went to the entrance. And he knew it was a terrible night and a reason that this visitor would be in need of shelter. Now upon opening the door, he was surprised to find a terrifying demon towering over him with large dead eyes and rotting flesh. Old man, let me apologize for doing the demon voice this morning. I've been reading The Hobbit to my sons at night, and I'm very into the voices, and so please tune into the podcast later as I do the demon voice. Old man, the demon hissed. I have traveled many miles to seek your shelter. Will you welcome me in? And without hesitation, the priest bid this hideous demon welcome and beckoned him into the church. So the evil demon stooped down and crossed the threshold, spitting venom on the tiled floor as he went. And in full view of the priest, the demon proceeded to tear down the various icons that adorned the walls and rip the fine linens that hung around the sanctuary while screaming blasphemy and curses. But during this time, the priest knelt silently on the floor and continued his devotions until it was time to retire for the night. Old man, cried the demon, where are you going now? Well, I'm returning home to rest, for it has been a long day, said the kindly priest. May I come with you, spat the demon. I too am tired and in need of a place to lay my head. Why, of course, said the priest. Come, and I will prepare a meal. And so on returning to his house, the priest prepared some food, while the evil demon mocked the priest and broke the various religious artifacts that adorned his humble dwelling. And the demon then ate the meal that was provided for him afterward. And then he turned to the priest. He says, "Old man, you welcome me first into your church and then into your house. And I have one more request for you. Will you welcome me into your heart?" "Why, of course," said the priest. "What I have is yours, and what I am is yours." And this heartfelt response brought the demon to a standstill, for by giving everything, the priest had retained the very thing that the demon sought to take, for the demon was unable to rob him of his kindness and his hospitality, his love and his compassion. And so the great demon left in defeat, never to return. What happened to the demon after this meeting with the elderly priest is anyone's guess. Some say that although he left the place empty-handed, he received more than he could have imagined. And the priest, he simply ascended the stairs, got into bed, and drifted off to sleep, all the time wondering what guise his Christ would take next. Peter Rollins, when he wrote that parable, kind of comments about it, and he calls it a case of impossible hospitality. Impossible hospitality, because this vision of welcoming a demon into the church, welcoming a demon into our homes, and then in a weird reversal, we tend to think of welcoming Christ into our hearts, welcoming a demon into our hearts seems strange, but it's a case of this radical hospitality. And yet, I wonder, as I reflect on that parable, if Jesus has asked us to do similar things when he says, "Love your enemies." I mean, one of the most provocative and distinctive aspects of Jesus' ministry was his practice of breaking bread, extending hospitality to and receiving the hospitality of tax collectors and sinners. And so when the church looks at Jesus, we see this case of boundary crossing where he's standing with and opening himself up to people that seem to be evil or impure or unclean. And then when we look at the way the church behaves, it doesn't often seem that the church follows Jesus into those practices of radical hospitality and radical welcome. And as a psychologist, I've often pondered why that is. The reasons I come up with are psychological reasons, and I want to share one of them with you now, one of the things I talk about in this book, and that's this notion of what ethicist Peter Singer, calls the moral circle. The moral circle is based on a simple two-step process. Basically, Singer argues that the human moral psychology is just really simple. The first part of the process is that we have a kind of a mental judgment and mental algorithm that separates the world from family and not family, kin and not kin, people I know and strangers. We see this, if you're a psychologist, you see this emerge with little children with the onset of stranger anxiety. When we start identifying, these are my family and these are strangers, and they start becoming hesitant to reach out to strangers. And so we mark this line in the sand. You are of my clan and my tribe, or you're not. And then the next part of the algorithm is simple. Those that are inside my moral circle, is what Singer calls it, those inside my moral circle, I extend kindness. In fact, the root of kin and kindness are the same. Kindness is what we naturally and intuitively and instinctively extend towards our in-group, our family. If not biological family, our spiritual family, our friends. People that are as close to us as brothers and sisters. The people on the outside of the moral circle, however, are treated very differently. They are not instinctively extended kindness. They're treated instrumentally as means to an end. And if they get in our way, if they become obstacles or they're not functioning properly, then we dispose of those people looking for somebody else that can help us out. That's very abstract, and so let me give you an example that I use with my students, okay? I used to wait tables to get through college. Anybody wait tables? Okay. So this is as being emotionally abused through years of being a waiter, this is a particularly biographical story here. Imagine you have a friend that is just starting off at a restaurant in town, a place that's very busy and gets a lot of tips. So this is a great job. And they've been going through their training, and finally, this night, tonight, is the night they're going to have their first night on the floor. They're not training anymore, but they're going to be working their own tables, getting their own tips. And you're very excited for your friend. You say, that's fantastic. A bunch of us will come, and we'll go, and we'll specifically ask to sit in your section, and it'll be fun, and you'll get to wait on us, and we'll give you a big tip. It'll be great. Okay? And so you go to the restaurant, you get there, you ask for your friend's section, you sit down, and when your friend finally comes to the table, they're kind of sweaty and stressed out. To language of the industry is they're in the weeds. Things are not working out, and the food's not coming out, and people are getting upset, and it's a very, very bad night. If you've ever waited tables, there are nights like this. And so I ask my students, when your friend comes to you, and they're stressed out, and the food is behind, and they're behind on all their tables, and people are getting upset, what do you say to your friend? What do you say? What would you say? You can talk to me. What would you say to your friend?
Don't worry about us.
Right? You'd say, don't worry. Listen, do not worry about us. Take care of your tables. When you get a moment, then come back. And in the language of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus would say, how does that make you distinctive if you do that for your friend? Because even the pagans will do that. That's how you treat a friend, right? There's no great moral demonstration when your friend is stressed out. You immediately instinctively say, don't worry. Put us last. Take care of yourself. We'll wait. And the reason why we treat our friends that way is because they're inside the moral circle. They're not a stranger to us. They are like family. But tonight, some of us will go out to eat. And we'll go out with friends. And we'll be vaguely aware that our server is stressed out. What we will become aware of is that our drinks aren't being filled quickly enough. The food is not coming out as quickly enough. And we're going to get more frustrated with this person. Because whoever this person is, they're not functioning well. Because that person is a stranger. That person is on the outside of the moral circle. And they're treated very, very differently. Here's the thing. That woman waiting on your table this evening, or tomorrow, or whenever, that is somebody's mother. That is somebody's daughter. That is somebody's friend. They're just not your mother. They're just not your friend. They're just not your daughter. And because they're not yours in your moral circle, you don't treat them that way, the way you treat your own family members, because they are on the outside of the moral circle. One of the things that Jesus is trying to get us to do is to live a life of radical hospitality where there are no strangers, where the moral circle is expanding and expanding, and more people are included, in the language of this parable, into our hearts, into our affections, and that we would treat people, ostensibly strangers, as blood relatives, as our own mother, our own daughter, our own best friend. And that's a radical thing to do. It is a daunting challenge to live in a world without strangers, to treat everybody as if they are in the middle of yours. But that's what Jesus did, treated everybody as if they were in his moral circle. So how do you start doing that? I mean, that's a huge challenge. Let me just end with this. I think the first step in expanding the moral circle is just learning to see people. Just see them. Try to an anonymous interaction throughout the day. The person washing the dishes in the cafeteria, the person checking you out at Walmart, the server at your table side. Try to see them. And take a minute to soften your heart towards this individual. And treat them and humanize what tends to be in our world fairly inhuman, capitalistic, or even bureaucratic situations, and to see people. One example of this, something I've done in my department, as the chair of the psychology department, I get to do things. I hate being a department chair, but I can do things like, you know what, it's Christmas, we're having hot chocolate on Fridays, and And people will do it, so that's great. So this kind of random things I care about. I don't really care about the paperwork, but hot chocolate on Fridays during Christmas is important. I don't know about you, but, you know, like, who cleans the toilet in your building? You know, at ACU, where I work, there are people that come in at night, like, I guess it's elves. They come in, and our toilets are clean in the morning. And who does that? Well, there's a company that ACU hires, and they come in at night, and they're there in the middle of the night, and we don't usually see them, and usually they're, at least in my state, largely kind of Hispanic women that do that. And we don't ever see them. But they're there, right? And so in a practice of trying to help our students see them, you know, one of the things we started doing is like, hey, we start handing out cards in our classes and say, write a note of appreciation. You know, we give the name, we call, we say, who's the lady that cleans our toilets? And we'll get their name and we'll say, here's her name. She's the one that's been doing this for you. See her. Write her a card and we'll pass a hat and we will get her a big gift card for the Christmas season. The idea there is you open your eyes to everybody around you. So we're no longer living in an anonymous world, but we're living with the moral circles expanded. And where Jesus says, the love that you have for your brothers and sisters is universal. And that we learn to love everybody as God has loved us.
Thank you. So I'm thinking after chapel, because Richard Beck is still somewhat of a stranger here, but also kin, that rather than just talking with him from a distance or shaking his hand, maybe we should all give him a big hug. Let's start practicing the radical hospitality. It doesn't matter. A reminder that you can hear more from Richard Beck at 4 p.m. at the Science Center, more fully developing this theme.